Were we not as hungry as they? Soon we were looking at newcomers with a fearful eye, wondering with each fresh arrival how much less there would be. Each night was a struggle, more fierce now that we were daily engaged in it. I saw, night after night, what I had not observed before. The lame, with their crutches, knocked away from them so that they fell and were unable to rise. The feeble separated from their supporters so that their numbers were halved. Many a time my husband stood aside, unable to face the fray. If I had not reproached him, his distaste of the whole procedure would have led him to starvation. As it was, more often than not, one meal sufficed for two. And when the crowd had dispersed, to sleep, to beg, to scavenge, in the cool of the night and early dawn, we sat in the quiet courtyards, or leaned our back against the pillars in the paved corridors, making our plans and thinking, always thinking. With each passing day, the longing for the land grew. Our plans were forged against a background of brown earth and green fields and the ripe rustling paddy. Not curiously, as they were, but as we had first known them, fresh, open, and unspoiled, with their delicate scents and sounds untamed, with the skies clear above them and the birds finding sanctuary amid the grasses. And at the same time, keeping the pace with these longings, our distaste for the city grew and grew and became a sweeping, pervading hatred. Better to starve when we were all bred than live here. Nathan said passionately, "Whatever happens, whatever awaits us, we must return." "But how? We have no money. My husband can till and sow and reap with skill, but here there is no land. I can weave and spin or plait matting, but there is no money for spindle, cotton, or fiber. For where shall a man turn who has no money? Where can he go? Wide, wide world, but as narrow as the coins in your hand, like a tethered goat, so far and no farther. Only money can make the rope stretch. Only money." Then one day, I thought I would set myself up as a reader of letters, such as there are in most villages, and surely also in cities. "Whoever heard of a woman reader," said Nathan, "no one will come to you. If I ask little and less than the others, custom there will surely be." Said I, "In any case, one must try. Even a few annas would help." "Do you think you could?" Nathan was half despondent, half eager, and somehow the eagerness alone communicated itself to me. "Yes, I am sure. If I write letters as well as I read them, I shall earn even more. How can you write without paper or ink?" "Who asks must provide," I said confidently. "Leave it to me." We looked at each other and hope stirred, albeit cautiously, making us cheerful. "We shall need about 10 rupees, Nathan said, "for our food on the way and to pay the carter, say 2 rupees more in case we are 3 days traveling. 8 letters a day at an anna each," I said, "say half that for rice each day." We made our calculations, crushing optimism whenever it arose so that we might be certain, absolutely certain. And at last we said to each other, "Soon we shall be back." All that day and many following, I sat by the side of the road leading to the bazaar, calling to those who passed, adding to the general clamor. Men hurrying by stopped to stare inquisitively before moving on. Idlers stood or sat around lazily, indulging their curiosity. Youths sauntered by insolent of eye and manner, speaking loudly and with exaggerated clearness to say to each other that I might hear. "Says she can read. These village folk certainly are getting above themselves. She's a writer as well. What do you suppose she writes with? Probably uses her..." Whispers, laughs. "Oh, come on, she is past all that. She must be mad to imagine." Grimly, I took no notice and went on with my cries. By the end of the day, my voice was hoarse. My mouth tasted of the dust that each passing pair of feet raised. My hair was full of it. I had earned 2 annas, and I spent it on a rice cake for us to eat in the morning. 1 year ended. A new one began. Worshippers at the temple brought garlands of jasmine instead of chrysanthemums, and roses had disappeared from the feet of the gods. Still, we stayed in the city. And whether from its fumes or from the blighting of our hopes, my husband began to suffer again from rheumatism. And at the same time, the old bouts of fever began. Over and over, I told myself, we must go from here, especially at night, when my husband lay beside me twisting and straining in his sleep. It seemed to be the one hope for him, and I would look at the yellow flare burning from the top of the temple, and at the carven gods vigilant about us, and only one prayer did I utter. I was returning to the temple one evening, hurrying so that I should be in good time for the meal, when I heard someone running after me, shouting something that I could not understand. I stopped at last and looked around, peering at the boy who had come up panting, but it was dusk and I did not recognize him. "Do not pretend you don't know me," he said accusingly. "I am Puli. I have come for my payment." "Payment? What payment? I owe you no one anything." I walked on quickly and the lad came after me. "I took you to the doctor's house, not so long ago either, and you promised to pay." I remembered now. It was the boy with the impudent face who had guided us. "If you do not," he continued threateningly, "it will be the worse for you. I am not used to being bilked." I could not help smiling. The child spoke like a man, using the words of a ruffian. "I would pay you if I could," I said placatingly, "but I have nothing. Come and see for yourself if you do not believe me." "I do not," he said frankly. "I will see for myself." I hurried on and he came after, dogging my footsteps in a suspicious silence. Nathan came running to meet me. "Where on earth have you been? The food has all gone. Luckily I was able to get near, otherwise we would have starved." "Blame this lad," I said. "He would stop and argue." Nathan peered at Puli. "Who is he? What does he want of you?" Before I could reply, the boy advanced. "I want payment. That's what I want," he said truculently. "I shall see that I get it." "Payment? What for?" asked Nathan, bewildered. He too had forgotten. "He guided us to the doctor's house," I explained, "when we first came." There was a pause. Nathan began sharing out the rice and dal, carefully tearing the plantain leaf he carried into three pieces on which to put each portion. I had, with the day's earnings, bought, as usual, one rice cake, which I now broke to go around. The boy stared at it. "You must have money, otherwise how could you buy rice cakes?" I sighed. I earned 2 annas a day by writing letters, sometimes a little more, sometimes a little less. "I buy food with it." "Which is not unreasonable," Nathan said impatiently, "seeing how one portion has sometimes to be stretched to three." At last, Puli seemed satisfied. He began to eat, and once more I saw that he had no fingers, only stumps. He himself did not appear to find any difficulty in managing without, except that once or twice he had to use both hands, and there was a certain awkwardness in his handling of the food. Despite myself, I could not keep my eyes off his hands. The harder I tried to keep my gaze fixed elsewhere, the more it fastened itself to those stumps. Puli, seemingly unaware, continued eating stolidly. "He is used to it," I thought. "He knows and accepts the shameful probing curiosities of human beings." When we had eaten and fed the leaves to the goats and washed, Puli, to my surprise, laid down beside us. "You had better go home," I said, nudging him. "What will your poor mother think if you stay here all night?" "I have no mother, poor or otherwise," he said. "There is no one to worry about me, and none to worry me either, which is a good thing." And turning on his side, he fell instantly asleep. I might have felt apprehensive for him, but that I knew him to be eminently capable of looking after himself, or sorry, save that he so patently did not desire it. But I could not help feeling a vague responsibility, which certainly I knew I was in no position to fulfill. "He is probably better fitted to fend for himself than we are," Nathan began, but although he was echoing my thoughts, I found myself turning on him indignantly. "How can you say such a thing? He's only a child, no more than 9 or 10. And he is not whole either, as we are." But that he was right, Puli demonstrated the next morning. When we woke, we found him sitting cross-legged beside us, frowning thoughtfully. "You earn 2 annas, he asked, "after working all day?" I nodded. "Sometimes 3 or 4. "Between 2 and 4, then," he amended impatiently. "Have you no wish to earn more? I stared at him. "If only I could," I said, half breathless. "Is there some way?" "There's a stone quarry," he said, "not far from here. Stone breakers earn good wages." "And who will employ us?" said Nathan sadly. "At our age, such heavy work would in any event be beyond us." "Age doesn't matter," the boy said impatiently. "As for who will employ you, there is no such thing. Anyone can go and work and be paid by the results. So much for each sackful." "Are we not beyond such labor?" "Indeed, no. All kinds of work in the quarry. Men, women, and children. I would work too," he added. "But I cannot hold a hammer or stone firmly enough. One can earn a lot if one works quickly." "Lead on," Nathan said. "We are in your hands." We heard the noise of the stone breakers long before we reached the quarry. A clink-clank of stone on stone with intermittent dull explosions. As we drew near, the din grew louder. We had to shout to make ourselves heard. The quarry was on the hillside, not the calm and pleasant Chamundi Hill, but another, lesser hill, bare and rocky, with here and there a few clumps of prickly pear. On one side of the hill, the land fell away sharply, almost vertically, and here was revealed the actual quarry, an enormous, irregular crater strewn with boulders and lined with jagged rocks, its sides pitted with the holes of varying sides. People were everywhere, some working in the quarry itself, others scattered about the hillside, the heftier among the men splitting boulders, the women and children dripping fragments of the larger stones. Movement everywhere, a myriad arms, rising and falling, hands flailing, backs bending and straightening in a relentless rhythm. At intervals, I observed a red flag being hoisted, which seemed to be some sort of danger signal, for those working in the vicinity immediately dispersed to wait at a safe distance. A shrill whistle also blew as a warning to those who had not seen, or who had disregarded the red flag. And within a few seconds followed the explosions we had heard when approaching the quarry. "The sheetrock is blasted by gunpowder," Pooley explained. The municipality sends special men to do that. But the other work can be done by anyone." So it seemed. There were all ages and sizes here, but we were at loss where to begin. "Begin here," Pooley said. "It is some way from the quarry where most of the blasting is done, and you won't have to run so often." He sat himself down, keeping a watchful eye on us. "I have never done this kind of work before," I said uncertainly. "I hardly know." "Oh, it is quite simple. You merely hammer the stones until they break. The only thing is you must get them the right size. See that pile there?" He pointed to a heap of stones, most of which were about the size of a child's fist. "Try and get them like that." And that was precisely the difficulty, to break the stones to the required size. Sometimes they were too big, sometimes too small. We struck lightly, and only chips glanced off the stone. We struck hard, and it fell to fragments. The air was full of flying dust and stone particles. Part of the trouble lay in keeping one's eyes open while striking. "It is not a simple way of earning," I said, "and it is way more difficult than it looks." And Nathan grumbled. "If we had a hammer, at least we would not have so much waste." Yet there were many like us without hammers and only using stones, who were making very good progress. Once or twice I stopped to watch, admiring and envious, while the stones broke obediently to the right size under the skillful blows and the knobbly heaps before them grew. Only once we were disturbed by blasting near us. Engrossed in our work, neither of us had observed the red flag, nor with the hammering constantly beating upon our eardrums did we hear the whistle go, but Pooley, more alert than either of us, hustled us to safety, and as we ran, we felt the ground shake beneath us. "You must learn to be careful," Pooley said severely, while stones and earth still rained down on us like hailstones. "Did you not hear the whistle, or the people who shouted to you? This blasting is a nuisance," he went on. "You will find your stones are scattered, but you will get used to it." The stones were indeed scattered and mixed inextricably with those of other workers. But when we had collected what we reckoned to be our pile, no one raised any objections. "Sometimes one loses, sometimes one gains," a man said philosophically. "It evens itself out." I was thankful there was the spirit of amity. We were neither of us anxious to engage in futile disputes. The sun was setting before we finished. The heaps of stones before us was not very large, nor to our proud eyes very small. All about us people were stopping work. As the light faded, so the clink and clank died. In the gathering darkness, only a few faint sounds of hammering told of a solitary stonebreaker continuing his labor. I turned to the boy beside us. "Well, what now? Who pays us?" "We must get a sack first," he replied. "Your husband had better wait here while we are gone. Come, I will show you the overseer's hut." I followed him. The hillside was full of moving people, some carrying laden sacks, others with wicker baskets on their shoulders which creaked with the weight of the stones, some of which tumbled from holes in the loosely woven wicker. The overseer's hut was built some distance away from the quarry, a small affair with thatched roof and pressed fiber walls. The two doors, one at either end, were both open. A long line of people was moving in slowly at one, from the other. People were moving, coming away, not with sacks, but with money. I joined the line empty-handed. Pooley was standing some distance away. From somewhere he had produced a begging bowl, which he had held in the crook of his elbow, while he displayed his mutilated hands to the passers-by. He had altered his voice, I noticed, making it weak and quavery while he uttered his singing song plea. "Take pity on an orphan child, take pity." Wrong place, I thought. Only the poor people come here. But to my astonishment, I saw one or two had dropped pies into his bowl. Soon he was able to rattle it, thus attracting even more attention. The line was moving slowly forward. I shuffled along with it. The man behind me was laden with two baskets. He kept prodding me with them until at last I turned around in irritation. Then I saw he was a very old man. The load he carried kept slipping over his lean shanks, and every time he hitched the baskets up, they bumped against me. My irritation vanished. "You have been busy today," I said. "No more than usual. I generally manage two baskets." "We were two," I confessed, "but I doubt whether we have filled even one." "You will work faster when you are used to it. You are new, are you not?" "Yes, first time we have been." "I thought so," he nodded. "You ought to collect your sack as soon as you get here. Otherwise, there is this long wait, and then you have to come back and wait again." I thanked him, feeling surprised that Pooley had not known. He was who was so competent in his own way. Then I reminded myself that despite his airs, he was only a child. My turn. I entered. A man was sitting on the floor, writing on a small raised wooden board resting on bricks before him. "How many?" He did not raise his eyes. "One only." He entered something in a book and readied for some coins. Then he looked up. "Where is your sack?" "I have not got one. I just have come for it," I stammered. "Why did you not ask in the first place?" He said, crossly, "Are you trying to get money for nothing?" He put the coins back on the pile, took the basket from those stacked behind him. "Here you are. No sacks left. And hurry, else you won't be paid tonight." I took it and ran back to Nathan. Breathless with haste, we filled the basket, and I was back while the line of waiters stretched before the hut.
2 sacks, 1 rupee. 3 sacks, 1 8.
The overseer's voice kept calling, monotonous, slightly weary. Stooping, I placed my basket in front of him. 1 sack, 8 annas, he called, then impatiently, altering his rhythm. Not there, behind with the others. I put the basket alongside the others. Now at last I was to be paid. He took out the money, 2 coins, each a 4 anna piece, dropped them in my palm. Nathan was waiting, eager and impatient. How much? 8 annas. We looked at each other, smiling jubilant. We shall soon be home, Nathan said softly. Think of it. It seemed natural that we should wait for Pooley, and sure enough, he joined us a few minutes later. The boy had attached himself to us of his own accord, and now both of us took it for granted he would remain. Well, I said as he came up, how did you fare? I saw you were busy. Not well at all, he replied dolefully, holding out 1 anna. That is all I got for my pains. I myself had heard the rattling of